Welcome to Formula Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we have a special pleasure today to welcome Jorge Ordóñez, a good friend and super important Spanish wine importer to the U.S. Jorge, how are you?
Good.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Jorge. Thanks for being here with us today.
My pleasure.
It's going to be fun.
We don't spend anywhere near enough time on Spain. Spanish wine, Spanish food, traveling to Spain. We both have great enthusiasm for it.
Absolutely. It's a beautiful country.
One of those reasons for the enthusiasm is having spent time with Jorge.
Mm-hmm.
As unpredictable as that might be sometimes.
Well, sorry.
Yeah. There's no question. There's no question that Jorge's enthusiasm for super high quality product in the kitchen, super high quality product in the vineyard. I've always felt like we were totally simpatico, you know, for continuation of quality in one place does not prohibit quality in the other place, and vice versa, that everything is on the same table.
You cannot love or make good wine or export or sell good wine or feel good wine without eating well. It's part of the program. I think the training of your palate involves excellent food. So the fresh ingredients, the herbs and everything, that's how we later relate to a good red wine or white wine. So I cannot imagine people having a good palate for wine if they spend all their life eating fast food, let's put it that way. As wine is a natural agricultural product produced from grapes, everything has to be attuned to that. And I think in the Spanish way, nobody drinks wine by itself over there. So when you go to a bar, to a restaurant, you ask for a glass of wine, they always give you what we call tapa or whatever, some olives, some ham, some cheese or whatever. But there is no drinking by itself. It's a different culture. Wine is part of life. And I encounter many Spaniards in my life that will never drink wine by itself. Or after dinner, when the dinner is finished, maybe a dessert wine from Andalusia, but no more wine, red wine or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like a fundamental part of eating or lunching or dining or whatever you want to call it in Spain.
So we always have listeners that ask us about traveling places, and they always ask us for travel advice. There are definitely people that come into retail stores that have begun to love Spanish wine, or in restaurants they order Spanish wine. And there are at times, restaurants in our area that serve Spanish food.
Mm-hmm.
If someone's going to Spain, what are the five most important things they need to know about the kitchen in Spain, about food in Spain? What makes that table special?
The first thing they have to think is a very diverse country with different weather conditions, very radical differences. While this summer, the north part of Spain, the Basque Country, Asturias, Cantabria, and Galicia was raining almost every day. In the south, we were on over 100 degree Fahrenheit on the beaches of Andalusia. So it's where you want to go. As well as the weather conditions are very diverse, the food is the same. So in the north, you could have a stew of beans with a spider crab or grilled fish like turbo or flétan, octopus, oysters, whatever. And in the south, you have fresh fried anchovies, red mullets, calamari situation. So it's kind of like the steaks are in the north. In the south, we have the pork, almost like similar to America. So the culture of the real Iberico pork is in the south, the best hams, the best meat from wild raised free-range pork are in the south. And then in the north, you have the cows because the green thing. So where I will go to Spain? First to Madrid, which is the capital. And you have more museums than any other place in Spain. The second largest collection of paintings in the world. But I mean, you have a lot of the gastronomy, the whole country is there. It's a nice city, welcoming, and so on. then, you know, Barcelona is a major destination. But I'm surprised that it's a major destination more than Madrid, because it's more like the culture of Catalonia, whether in Madrid you could find...
It's distinctly different.
It's kind of like different. It's almost like going to the Basque Country, San Sebastian or Bilbao, which are great destinations for food. You have the touch of the Basque culture there, like a concentrated soup of Basque culture. The same thing is Barcelona, concentrated soup of Catalonian culture, which is great. And then you have Andalusia, which is incredible because the oldest city in Europe is in Andalusia. It's Cadiz, unbeknown to most of the people. It's a walled city by the Atlantic, which survived many tsunamis and has been there forever. And that's why the Phoenicians came to Spain first, then the Greeks, looking for the riches of Andalusia, mining operations. Cadiz, Seville, Cordoba, Malaga, Almeria, Granada, of course, with the more influence. Mm-hmm. The south is so diverse and beautiful, and the weather is always better. So, I mean, you could go to any place in Spain and have a lot of fun. I mean, the Valencia, Alicante, Extremadura, but it's so different. The country is a country that fit a couple of times in the state of Texas, and is so diverse, weather, food, wines, culture.
Because we're always hungry, if I give you a region, can you name a dish that's emblematic of that region?
Maybe, if you go slow.
So up in the Northwest, in Galicia, what is the most typical dish in Galicia?
Well, the most typical dish and the emblematic dish in Galicia is the pulpo a la gallega, octopus Galician style, which is a local octopus, unfortunate poor guy, that is boiled in a copper pot, traditionally, okay. A big pot with some onions for 1 hour and a half, submerged three times in the pot so it doesn't lose the skin, and then slowly cooked for 1 hour and a half, 2 hours. After the picture, the octopus, believe it or not, is very tender and never cut with a knife, and cut with scissors, and serve with a bit of lukewarm potatoes, sea salt, and paprika, and extra virgin olive oil. And if you are hungry, the best bread in Spain, by far, is the Galician bread. So that's a lunch by itself. After saying that, the main source of shellfish in Spain is Galicia. They have a collection of crabs, including the famous centollo, or spider crab, which is also found, you know, in the shores of America, in the Northeast and in California, but never commercially fish. And then we also have a crab that is very similar to the Dungeness crab called Buey de Mar. And then we have beautiful oysters and all type of clams. But the most emblematic dish in Galicia is octopus, for sure.
I'm going to ask you every time.
Yeah.
So the one wine from that region. Because this whole program is just a lesson.
The wine from Galicia certainly is Albariño. Mm-hmm. Follow, because it's more rare, the Godello grape. So these are the two main grapes there. Albariño and both Godello work with incredibly well with the local seafood, as usual in the old world.
We did have lunch, and I did taste your excellent Albariño. Would you tell listeners about the wine, because it's super high quality?
We make an Albariño from older vines planted in the 80s, and it's called La Caña Navia, which is the goddess of the waters in Galician culture. One vineyard is on the beach, basically. You could just, like, take your swimming trunks and swim after harvest. And the other is nearby 18th century church and cemetery. So that's why the wine is so rich. It has a lot of minerals from the dead people. And
oh my!
And then we ferment the wine for 1 year, and is special. That's all.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. All right, so let's move east a little bit, away from those dead people.
Yep.
Yeah, voila.
And maybe how about Asturias?
Asturias, the national dish is, of course, Cabrales situation, and the cheese.
And there's another cheese that...
La Peral.
Mm. La Peral.
Oh, my gosh.
La Peral. I love that stuff.
La Peral is, for me, is the
runny,
most delicate...
sexy, gorgeous cheese.
Blue cheese. I use it a lot for blue cheese sauce on my filet mignon.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
I use the trick.
I love
it. And my girlfriend said, well, that's...
It doesn't sound like a trick. It sounds like a filet mignon with a big piece of blue cheese on it.
Yes, I put a lot of cheese and a little bit of cream. And, of course, the fabada asturiana, the white broad bean situation... with chorizo, asturiano, schmuck, chorizo, and then blood pudding, you know, schmuck too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, that's
the
it.
The beans are so good.
So blue cheese and pork and beans are what you're telling me.
But the beans there, the people are pretty nasty about that.
What do you mean?
So, I mean, nasty means like you don't buy in the supermarket and say... They buy directly from the guy that grow them.
It's sounds
like
good.
My guy. And I have been in restaurants in Asturias and show me a complete 2 freezers, chest full of beans, vacuum pack, because they harvest them fresh, the vacuum pack them, and freeze them.
Good.
I mean, in season, they cook them directly, but otherwise, it's like you know, they don't buy them dry as we do the rest of the country.
Got it. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So let's see, what is next? Castilla y León.
Castilla y León is lamb, lamb, lamb. If you don't like lamb, don't go there.
Love lamb.
And, of course, great, cheap milk cheeses. Superbo ones there. That's the 2 cornerstone there. I mean, the beef is little because it's very bare lands, very dry.
Why don't you take us up a little bit further north to País Vasco? People always do want to go to San Sebastian, it seems like.
The Basque Country, the best thing they do is, of course, grilled seafood. North Atlantic grilled seafood. Turbo, which is the cousin of fletan, which I forgot in English. What's the name of the fletan?
Halibut.
Yes.
Halibut, okay.
Yeah, the cousin, the European cousin of halibut is turbo. It's fantastic grill with charcoal for 1 hour, and they put a lot of olive oil.
What do you mean? You're talking about the whole fish?
Yeah, they put the whole fish in a basket, in a wire basket, so the fish doesn't go away, and he'd sit there on the charcoal with basting constantly with olive oil, lemon, vinegar, sauce that they make.
Okay, I want to have that.
And, beans, steaks. It's like the past, like northern people by the Atlantic, you need a lot of energy. And so it is the food there. Grilled seafood, grilled meats. The wine there, of course, is the Chacolí.
My favorite breakfast wine.
Yes. Don't drink too much.
But it's not that strong.
It's not. But
that's what people think.
It's easy.
I have once a trip with 22 Americans, and we drink 45 bottles of Chacolí.
That's probably too many for breakfast.
Yes, and I need the dog that take care of the sheep to look after them because they were all lost on the fields.
And wandering around aimlessly.
People don't... Chacolí is an unusual wine.
Yes, it's a frisante type of wine made with 2 very rare varieties, on the Rabi Suri and on the Rabi Belsa. And the vineyards are hanging in cliffs overlooking the Atlantic. In the winter, these things are suffering a lot because, you know, the road to the town of Getaria, for example, I mean, I have been there going for 30 years, has been destroyed 3 times by big northeasters there.
Wow.
So, like, boulders coming down.
Gosh.
But anyway, the wine is superb. It's very light, easy to drink, and perfect for acidity for the local anchovies that they produce. Superb anchovies. Done by the local women. I remember one day going to one of those places that the women clean the anchovies before they can in olive oil. And I was smoking out of the factory, so I enter, and the place smelled like anchovies, of course. Mm-hmm. Imagine the stench of the anchovies, everywhere they got on the anchovies and everything. The ladies, you smell horrendous. You have been smoking. I say to the ladies, you smell worse.
Well,
you smell
sometimes, sometimes us non-smokers,
yes,
you know, you bother us. Jorge.
But they were not so delicate, let me tell you. Yeah. Just to see the characters.
So
they were nice ladies.
They pack the anchovies in oil.
Yes. Yes.
I bet that is super good.
What else you want to go for food?
Well, we're going to go to a few more regions and just a few moments. Mm-hmm. When we come back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, we'll have a little more time with Jorge Rudonez talking about, I guess it's really Spain 101, Food and Wine. All of that and more on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're spending time today with Jorge Rudonez, who's a good friend, a really important Spanish wine importer, and is the best authority I know on Spanish food and wine, and enthusiastic consumer of both.
We're glad you're with us. Thank you for joining us today and sharing all your knowledge and wisdom.
We're doing a little Spain 101, Food and Wine, and we spent a little time on a couple of the regions in the first installment. Let's spend some more time. Let's talk about the center of the country.
Center of the country is Madrid. Madrid is all the cuisine of the whole country there. Represented like going to New York.
So you would expect to find food from Extremadura, from Catalonia, from
The national dish in Madrid, the capital of Spain, is el cocido madrileño and the callos a la madrileña, which is callos mean tripe, madrileña style, which is a soup with tripe, evidently, and chorizos, and, you know, slowly cook a lot of paprika, the very clean tripe, which is the most important thing. I used to hate tripe when I was a kid, but my mother told me as long as they are clean, they are good. And so otherwise, they smell like you know what. Mm-hmm. And this is a natural dish there, along with the cocido madrileño, which is cocido is a dish found in Madrid South, which basically is garbanzo beans boiled with cured lard and ham and beef chunk and pork and you name it, and a lot of vegetables, including parnish, celery, and carrots. Like 5 hours too. That resulted in a very nice, rich, soupy situation, which the locals drink first, and then they serve the rest of the story, the garbanzo beans, all the meats, and the potatoes, and the parnishes, everything separate.
So almost dry?
Yeah, almost dry.
Okay, so the broth is first, and then the...
Yes.
That sounds good.
So after that, you need to go to bed or to the hospital, either or, your choice. But people love it.
With the dish and before going to bed at the hospital, what does one drink?
Of course, a nice bottle of Tempranillo. Mm. Yeah, whether it's from Rioja, Ribera del Duero, Toro, something like a red, robust wine.
Talk about Toro for a second, because I think Toro is one of those regions that people don't, I think that people in general know Tempranillo, and they know Rioja, but they don't know Toro. So what makes Toro particular for the Tempranillo grape?
In 1985, I was reading a lot of the history of Spanish wines, and I noticed most of the history of Spanish wines written by French travelers, and I noticed that the wines of Toro seem to be the most popular wines in Spain in the 14th, 15th, and 16th, 17th century. The only ones that didn't pay taxes when they entered the cities at the time, you'd be grain, wine, or alcohol, or whatever. Cotton into a city, you had to pay taxes to enter. These wines were free of taxes. And I wonder why. Then I read that they were the only appellation that resists phylloxera, the plague that destroyed the vineyards in Europe, because the soil are so particular, very uneven and very sandy, that the bug that destroyed the vineyards cannot survive there. And then you notice that the vineyards are very low yield and so on, and very high altitude. For me, it's the Shangri-La of Tempranillo in Spain. Very low yields, very consistent weather. So you want to make money, that's not the right place to go. But if you want to make great wines, that's the place to go. And when I went there, were 7 wineries. When I left there momentarily, there were 80. So it's one of these areas that, you know, we rediscovered for the Spanish viticulture. I think is going to be very important in the future, and more important, and an alternative to the Rioja wines and the wines of Ribera Duero. I'm not saying anything against them. Rioja has its history, and Ribera Duero has its history, but truly, the oldest Tempranillo known by the Spaniards in Spain are the ones of Toro. The kind of the Rioja wines, history is recent, 200 years old, versus the wines of Ribera Duero, 150 years. So Toro is only 1 hour and a half away, 2 hours, sorry, from northwest Madrid. And why the locals eat cheese, superb cheese, and lamb also, like any place in Castile. Castilla-León is north of Madrid. It's a big plateau there, and is the land of the lamb.
Just for listeners to get the important differences between those three big Tempranillo zones, Ribera del Duero.
Yeah, in the center. So basically, you go from north to south and from north to west. The first area defined is Rioja, which is the closest to Bordeaux. It's only 4 hours and a half away, and the closest to the Atlantic. So you have very cold weather, Tempranillo.
I mean, I was there at harvest with you in October when there was snow.
Yeah.
In a particularly not good year.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, they are challenged by the Atlantic weather condition that if you didn't have the big mountain range protecting them to the north, Rioja wouldn't exist. So it's kind of like a buffer zone, limit cultivation area. In the other side of the mountain range, you cannot grow anything. I mean, you can grow peppers. No, you cannot grow tomatoes. So it's kind of like very harsh limit conditions. And then you go to Ribera Duero, is higher than Rioja, in the valley of the Duero River. You know, we're talking always valleys of the rivers, like any great wine regions of the world. And over there is more uneven, more dry, and higher altitude. And then you go to Toro, you get even higher altitude than all of them. And the soil, the poorest soil of all of them, with the less water, is Toro. So you have more concentration as you go down to the west.
Hmm. And you have a project, you have a winery there now.
Yeah, because I like to drink good wine. Too. I have that problem.
Tell people what the winery is.
The winery is Jorge Ordóñez Winery in Toro. This is the name, very simple. And we made three wines there. We made a wine called Triton. We went made with all vines and grafted material. Then we have a wine called Batan, which is from a vineyard planted in 1900. So the vineyard right now is 118 years old.
And so let's go east.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to Catalonia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can't wait to hear this.
Well, they say Catalonia is almost like Andalusia. You have the cuisine of the coast and the cuisine of the mountain. Okay, so you have the beautiful, I wouldn't say paellas, but for our listeners to understand, we'll call them paellas rather than the local name is arroz, rice.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a collection of beautiful seafood-based rice. So shellfish, they are focused more in the red shrimp, the cigalas, like we have in Andalusia, the same thing, and very good rice by the beach and the water. And the mountain changed completely. You could have escargot, you could have more vegetables and hearty dishes like wild boar, easily in the mountains, escudellas, big stews with a lot of sausages and everything floating around there. So it's more like a French heavy-duty countryside cuisine, if any comparison, solving the differences, It's superb. I mean, it's like if you can get away from the touristic trap in a big city, evidently. Like the same thing in Madrid, you get like a regular thing. It's like, but you could find a lot of those. But if you get to the local restaurants, the Catalan cuisine is full of history and variations. So you don't think about one particular dish. You have to go to a lot of them. I mean, one of my favorite dishes is the weirdest one. is the roasted onions over embers, you know, the one, you know, the John spring onions that they bury into the embers or the charcoals for half an hour, 1 hour.
So good.
Then they pull them out, wrap them in old newspapers, and then you dip them in the sauce, calçot sauce, which is made with hazelnuts, tomatoes.
Lots of garlic.
Lots of garlic and a number of things there. Vinegar, it's kind of thick dipping sauce. So by the time you finish with all these grilled onions, your face is black, at least. But it's delicious. I like to have with a good bottle of cava.
So most of the cava, I guess people think of a high-quality cava, mostly comes out of Catalonia, right?
That's correct. You can find other high-quality cavas in Rioja, but 99% of the production of good quality cava is from Catalonia. Cava is not an appellation that describes a geographic region. Cava is an appellation that protects the way in which the product is made in Spain. So it has to be method champenoise. So it has to be made like any champagne, fermented in the bottle in order to be cava. In cava appellation today is all Catalonia, some parts of Valencia, some parts of Extremadura, and Rioja.
Let's go down the coast to Valencia.
Yep. Valencia is about rice. That's the place, birthplace of paella. And the original paella is the marking point of all these restaurants all over the world and all this food. Unfortunately, paella is misrepresented by many of the restaurants abroad of Spain, and even by the ones in Spain. So has been an association lately to protect the authenticity of paella. The original paella, I think, is made with eels, which was normally found in the marshlands of Valencia, escargot, and rabbit. And three different vegetables. It's like two beans and a green bean, which is a green bean that is whiter than the Italian broad red bean. Very uncommon, only found in Valencia.
I was going to say it's indigenous to that region, so it's like so special.
To find the original place, you have to go there. You find an original paella dish in Malaga, period. And the locals play with it. Instead to use rabbit, they use chicken, some variations. So people throw artichokes. I have been in that situation. But the rest is different. I mean, you have the arroz a banda, which is one of my favorites, which is just rice with a heavy-duty stock of fish, made with monkfish and shrimp peas and a lot of, you know, rockfish. Scorpion fish also.
Mm. Scorpion fish give the best stock.
Yes. Oof. And you have like a very orangey stock that you boil the rice. And after eating the rice, like in the case of the dish of Madrid, the people serve the potatoes and the fish that you use for the stock with a heavy-duty alioli, if you are still hungry. Of course, I never eat the potatoes. What's the point of eating potatoes after having rice?
Rice, yeah. Okay. So can you still get these dishes prepared traditionally?
Oh, yeah, good. Yeah, okay, yeah, good. Yeah. You could get a collection of places.
Good.
So the restaurant Paco.
Paco and Diaz in Alicante.
Yeah.
And my favorite place for rice in Spain has been voted by many Spanish serious magazines, No Fly By Night, as the best rice in Spain. And it's not a traditional paella, but it's a arroz made with rabbit. They raise themselves the rabbit, but it's not the rabbit bunnies that you have, your kids have in the garage, you know, white looking and with red eyes. They're very scary. See, these are, they are rabbits, they are dark, you know, like wild rabbits. They are fed good vegetables until they die, and wild escargot. In Mediterranean, wild escargot is crazy because escargot comes from normally from humid areas, green grass, and that's why you have all these big, delicious escargot bourguignon situations, like a big, fat escargot, because they eat grass all day long. these poor things.
These are little teeny tiny escargot.
Yeah, because they never see any grass. They
you
are
said
unlucky.
These poor things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they don't have the grass that the neighbors from France have. So these people live in survival mode and they eat everything they can, which means ended up eating a lot of rosemary by necessity and stuff like that. So they taste like rosemary. Mm. And once you don't find them, the chef tell you, if you don't have the escargot from the mountain, use rosemary as a substitute. Okay. And it works. Uh-huh. Anyway, so they do rabbit and escargot situation. And the poor lady, Josefa, which is the chef at the restaurant, cooked under inhumane conditions.
That's like, a serious kitchen.
Yeah. It's just like she cooked with vine cuttings. So it's an open fire made with wood from the vineyards. And the temperature there is impossible. You cannot get closer to the paella pan than, I would say, 2 feet. Once you get 1 feet, you just start burning yourself. She doesn't have to go to the laser removal program for her because she has no hairs, no eyebrows, and she's always very skinny. And the poor thing works, in the summer. In the town, the temperature is 110. Imagine when in the kitchen with no air conditioning. But the rice is masterpiece.
The rice is amazing.
What's the name of the restaurant? Amazing.
Paco Gandia.
Yeah.
I'm going there.
It's a haul to get there, and it's totally worth it.
Yes.
And you'll get lost at least 4 times on the way.
Yes.
Okay, next time you go, can I go with you?
Yes, please.
Please, thank you.
So when we come back, if these guys don't leave and go get some arroz, we'll have a little more education on Spain, food and wine, and more time with Jorge Bedoñez. All of that and more on Foreman & Wolf on Food and Wine. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're lucky enough to be spending some time with Jorge Ordóñez, landmark importer of Spanish wine, and definitely most knowledgeable gourmand and amateur chef and Spanish fisherman that I know. Anyway, I've had a chance to travel with Jorge a little bit in Spain, and we're trying to bother him into sharing a little bit of his vast knowledge of what to know about Spain.
Yeah, it's really a treat to have you here with us, Jorge. Thank you so much for
Pleasure.
Being here.
So go ahead and take us home. Take us to Andalusia.
Well, Andalusia, like the rest of the country, it is a country by itself, basically the south.
Andalusia is facing Africa, right on the south coast of Spain.
Yes. The most southern part of Andalusia is the Rock of Gibraltar. And Gibraltar is very narrow, straight. So from my home in Malaga, I can see Africa and Gibraltar in clear nights. I can see the cities,
That's
the lights
amazing.
Of the cities. So we are very close across the strait. Andalusia is the oldest of all the regions, and the oldest city in the world is Cadiz, as I said before. I mean, the world, sorry, in Europe, all right? It was founded by the Phoenicians. In home of a kingdom, legendary kingdom, found in the Bible today, called the Kingdom of Tartessos, and whose king, Argantonio, he was believed to live he was 150 years old. At the time, they didn't have preserved foods or anything like that. Everything was natural. So that may be the case. The diversity of Andalusia is even more than perhaps comparatively to the rest of the country, because we have more mountains there than any other place in Spain, except for Asturias. The province of when I was born, Malaga, has more mountains than any other place in Spain. So the people grow very separated for many years. So from the gastronomy of Huelva, the closest western location to Portugal, to the gastronomy of Cadiz, which has the best bluefin tuna in the world, catch in the old-fashioned way, you have a tremendous diversity. I mean, you could go there and have sashimi that you never have in Tokyo.
And that's amazing. That's amazing.
What is catching bluefin tuna in the old-fashioned way?
Catching bluefin tuna in the old-fashioned way is the almadraba system, named by the Arabs. But the Romans already did it. And it's basically you throw a net, humongous net.
Wow, yes.
In the Atlantic, perpendicular to the beach, that is with floaters, evidently. It's a wall net. And anchor with anchors the size of your living room, basically, to prevent the humongous currents of the Atlantic to remove the net.
Do you do that from a boat or from
You set it up in a boat.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And then at the end of the net, as you go far away from the beach, you set up a labyrinth trap. So the tuna goes there, migrating, going to the Mediterranean to make the things to reproduce and to lay the eggs around Turkey and Greece. But first they have to enter the Strait of Gibraltar, and Cadiz is very close to that, so they follow the coast, eating delicious anchovies and sardines, local fare, and having fun, and then they hit the wall, the net, and then the net...
It's all fun on the beach until you hit the wall.
Right? Yeah, and then they try to get out, and they found this beautiful labyrinth. They get in, and they cannot get out, and then they harvest them fresh. It's like, boom. And so... I mean, I go to the main area of harvesting. The nets are set in between May and July when the tonnage is limit. They remove them. It's not year round, so it's very, environmentally friendly situation. Sure. You don't go after them with helicopters and planes and boats. They just get into the net naturally, and we ship them to Japan or we then locally. But again, the complexity of the food is you always have in Andalusia the same thing you have in Catalonia or you have same thing you have in Valencia, the cuisine of the coast and the cuisine of the mountain. So within not mileage, you could have in Cadiz or Huelva, for example, superb shrimps and coquina, Venus clams or whatever. But if you go up, you get the best Iberico ham in Habugo.
So it's the best place in the world, pretty much.
Yes, and agriculture is tremendous. Like the biggest greenhouses in Europe are in Almeria. So the tomatoes, the lettuce, and the English, the Germans eat are produced in Andalusia too. So it's the land of the riches. Mm. And everything is so... cheap agricultural base because I don't know why, but comparison with here, but because we don't have to travel so much, I guess. Just like your fruit, our orchards are next door.
Food traveling costs not only fuel, it costs on a human scale too.
Labor, everything. When you eat tuna like that, how is it prepared? Do you eat it raw? And
I mean, we're starting to eat
oil?
It raw because, I mean, the best way to eat the thing, but I mean, we have tuna con tomate. Mm. Atún con tomate is quite good. And tarantelo asado with Pedro Ximénez reduction. Oh. It's brutal, served over mashed potato situation. It's like the richest part of the tuna if you do it right with some wine and so on. I mean, you can do it. I mean, you could do anything you want. We make meatballs made out of tuna, bluefin tuna. Incredible. You can make bolognese, which I have done, with bluefin tuna. As long as the quality of the tuna is premium, you can do just like inimaginable things with bluefin tuna. The chef of the Mars, sorry to interrupt, the guy that has a 3-star Michelin restaurant in El Puerto Santa Maria, Angel León, he makes sausages with tuna. Like he makes saucisson, lomo, chorizo, made with bluefin tuna that you wouldn't notice it unless somebody told you.
That's amazing. I've never heard of that. That's cool.
So you mentioned Pedro Ximénez.
Yes.
Which makes me think of sherry.
Yes.
Which makes me think of tapas.
Yes.
So the origin of tapas...
is in the south.
Is in the south.
Because we have more flies than in the north.
And that's the story,
why
right?
You put the plate over the glass of wine.
500 years ago, a bar with no anything. So right. It's a pretty disgusting place, must believe.
But bar flies cliche for more than one reason.
Yes. And so the locals cover the wine with the tapa situation, which is almost the same thing we do today. You order a glass of wine in Granada or a beer, preferably a glass of wine. And you ended up
for those of us in the wine business.
Yes, exactly. And you ended up with tapas. In Granada, people go out for dinner without paying anything for the food.
Oh, yeah.
They have the program all together. Say, okay, I get two pieces of cheese here with this guy, and I get to the other bar, a piece of sausage on, a croquette. Mm. It's incredible. The hardcore place for the tapa is Granada. You can spend like a whole evening eating like a pig without paying anything for the food. Just pay for the wine. And they are not expensive either.
And they're really good.
It's the locals demand the food with the wine.
Granada.
Yes.
I mean, tapas and Jerez, is that something you grew up with?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up with Amontillado because, I mean, like I was more closer to Cordoba. And I drink a lot of fino from the barrels while still fermenting and aged with the lees and so on. So I used to drink a lot of fino straight from the barrel, which is very aromatic. And because the finos of Cordoba hasn't been 45, they are lighter to drink, so you could drink a bottle and not feel too bad. And I remember sitting in the taberna with the local flamenco players and compositors of the songs of flamenco, and I invite them for fino and some tapas, and they sing to me, and we spend our life 4 or 5 hours drinking fino and listening to the best flamenco in the world.
Sounds brutal.
Yeah, that sounds great.
In the streets of Cordoba. And,
beautiful picture.
In
you
a
just
bar
painted.
Called Taverna Salinas, which is still there, but it's not as good.
I'm sorry to take you away from home, but let's talk about Extremadura, because I think people have no idea that it exists.
Extremadura is the most beautiful untouched part of the country.
So where is it in Spain?
That's west of Madrid and southwest also. It stretches from Andalusia to Castilla y León. It's a very large region. Very wild. It's one of the few places you have forest. It's the source of all our oak and landscape more original to what Spain was. Spain forests were composed out of the wild oak, you know, called encina and alcornoque. So it's the white oak called encina, and alcornoque is the cork tree. And so that's why all the cork come from there. Amongst it, the best Iberic products from Guijuelo. So going to Extremadura and eating tremendous amount of jamón, chorizo, lomo, and all this kind of stuff, it's like the food there is incredible. They also produce most of the tomatoes that we eat in Spain, by sure. And they have some very good wines in Almendralejo, which is an appellation down there. The Extremadura appellation produce very good wines.
Wines like what?
Tempranillo-based wines like Lar de Barros, for example. Or, you know, there's many brands out there. Palacio Quemado. Basically, most of them are based Tempranillo with other additions like they have Cabernet, Merlot, and so on. I mean, Extremadura, which I crossed like the last year 3 times to go to Toro, precisely. Going from Andalusia is a good, quick way because the roads are fantastic. Has a lot of history. One of the most beautiful cities is Mérida with Roman amphitheater, and you name it. It's like going to Rome, but in the middle of nowhere. And it's pretty wild. It's like you see nature everywhere. Hunting is very popular there, so it's kind of like it's for the outdoors people. It's the best place. You have big rivers, big dams, and people go fishing. And it's very for the outdoors guy. And history guys, too. I don't know. It's beautiful. I mean, it's like very untouched. Although you have agriculture, the place is so big that you see more forest than any other place in Spain.
What have I missed? The islands?
The islands.
So what is the best wine made on the islands?
Well, in Canary Islands, the grape there is Malvasia, the ancient Malvasia. It's like in Malaga, the ancient grape is Moscatel de Alejandría, brought by the Phoenicians. In the islands is the Malvasia, also brought by somebody, we don't know who. The islands are very volcanic. Canary Islands are the west of the coast of Sahara Desert, Morocco, whatever you want to call it. They are mountainous, some of them 100% volcanic. And the best food there is the original recipes from the Guanches, the people that were living there before the Spaniards arrived. So there's a lot of Berber sauces, like the green the mojos are popular there. So it's kind of like cilantro, onion, garlic, and chilies, and so on, with olive oil, and then a combination of the things. They have like, I think, 100 different recipes of sauces to go with, wow. Which made the chimichurri like nothing, with all my respect to chimichurri. And they have, you know, they boil the potatoes in seawater until they shrink, and you dip them on these sauces, and they have the weirdest collection of fish that I've ever seen. So now then, first time when I went to Canary Islands, I said, I've never seen this fish, because the fish in there is...
Well, the South Atlantic fish, right?
So. Just can't start to be like that, but it's very difficult. It's rockfish, everything, because they don't have a continental shelf. So the fish is kind of like more parrotfish. It's kind of like eating a tropical fish without the situation of being poisonous. And the restaurants are the good ones are very simple. You go to the restaurant and say, what you have to eat? They say, come to the refrigerator, the open refrigerator, which one you want. They eat a lot of moray eel, stuff like that. I mean, I like it. I mean, they have rabbit, evidently, because it's the food from the islands. And they don't have a lot of chip and stuff like that. They got good cheeses down there. And the people are very nice, and the weather is fantastic. And if you go to interior, they have this thing similar to chorizo, what we call sobrasada, which is like spreadable chorizo over your beautiful farm bread. And for dessert, they have ensaimadas. They have incredible pastries there. The people from Balearica, they play with a lot of almonds and honey and stuff like that.
So for this next vacation that Cindy is clearly planning to Spain.
Oh, yeah.
So what is the one place, the one restaurant she needs to eat in that's simple, and what's the one restaurant she needs to eat in that's fancy?
Simple. I don't know. I think the Paco Gandia, that would be, although maybe you have been there. No?
She would know.
She should go to Paco Gandia. This is like the simple expression. Also, is a woman chef. That she worked her ass off, and you know she will be impressed with that.
I would love to go there.
To find somebody that works harder than you is difficult, and yeah, that will be it. And something better, I don't know.
Something fancy.
I mean, I like that a lot, but I think I have more pleasure in real, precise food that has been there, that represents tradition, and the flavors are clean and
perfect.
Impressive and rare. More than the sophistication that comes from a complex cuisine situation.
It sounds like he's becoming Italian.
No. I'm not becoming Italian. I mean, my best friend is Italian, by the way, Louis.
Well, Jorge, thanks for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much.
Giving us your version of a lecture on Spanish food and wine. There's no way we could get across what you get across to people, and clearly what they have to do in traveling is just...
Yeah.
Contact Jorge Ordóñez in Malaga and go right to his house.
Yes, a travel agent.
And he'll show you around.
Oh, boy.
Anyway, I think that's all we have time for. If you want to listen further to this episode or others, you can go to the WYPR website, wypr.org, look up the Foreman Wolf page, and download any of the podcasts that you like. If you want to contact us via email, it's foremanwolf@wypr.org. And on social media.
You can follow me on Instagram as Chef Wolf or on Twitter as Chef Cindy Wolf.
I'm the real Tony Foreman on Instagram. And that's all we have time for. Thanks so much for listening.
And happy Sunday.